Hi, friends. Welcome to another episode of the 10 Laws Podcast with East Forest. I am Easter Forest. Thanks for joining me this week. We have a wonderful conversation with Keith Campbell. Keith is an expert on narcissism. He's a researcher and a teacher and an author, and he wrote a really great book about it. And I heard him on the Joe Rogan podcast, and we were lucky enough to get him over here to go a little bit deeper into it. And he's just a really sweet guy. And I think this is an important subject to dive into because it seems like what role does narcissism play in the world and in our lives, and how can we be aware of it and essentially work with it? So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation very much. Before we get into that, I just want to let you know you can still pre-register for the event this winter in Salt Lake City. We have not set the exact date and location yet, but essentially you're pledging your interest to attend. You can get that back, so to speak. Like, once we pick a date and venue, you'll be notified and you can decide whether or not you'd like to officially attend at that point when it's ticketed and goes on sale. But that's at eastforest.org/tour. You can learn more about that East Forest Ceremony concert that's going to be live in person. With all the COVID protocols we can muster. As you can imagine, it's a very dynamic, moving process right now. So we're just trying to make sure we can do what we want to do and putting all of our ducks in a row. Also, we've got a merch sale going until December 3rd. So I believe when this podcast comes out, I'm recording this on Sunday, and the 3rd is Thursday. Yeah, so it's Community 2020. Is the 20% off code at the merch store, also at eastforest.org. So it's a great way to, there's like some bundles there too that already have savings. So you slap on the discount code and it's by far the largest savings you'll get all year. And actually the folks on our mailing list, if you're not on the mailing list yet, they got a little code for 25% off. So it's a good reason to get on the newsletter, which is relatively infrequent, but we try to put out things that you might be interested in, and geographical targets for shows and things like that. I'm still in Boulder, but I'm leaving tomorrow to head back north. Going to be up north for the winter, more or less, as far as where I'm basing out of. It's been absolutely beautiful down here, but it's also getting pretty cold. But we have some interesting things coming up in the East Forest world that I'm quite excited to share with you. They've just been in the works in the background, so I feel like it's too soon to tell you all the details. But in the meantime, I hope you're enjoying the Spores record, and thank you for all your support, for everyone who's giving this podcast a review and the ratings on iTunes podcast. You can do that while we're talking here right now, and the messages via info@eastforest.org, and just like the way you guys tag and share stuff and send messages on social media, at East Forest on Instagram and East Forest Music on Facebook and Twitter. So thank you. I really appreciate it, especially in a time of the pandemic. It's a way that helps me feel connected to all of you. So it's not just me talking in a microphone. I used to get to see you more at live shows, which will happen again. And as we're trying to plan one for this winter in Salt Lake City, but it's just a nice way to try to stay connected and be in conversation together as we walk through this really crazy time. The COVID stuff, as you know, it's increasing and increasing. And I'm personally having a hard time with some of my friends. You know, people are in such different universes about this. I tend to take it a bit more seriously. And I have a lot of friends who frankly don't. And it's hard. It's hard because that's kind of, you know, us being on different planets as a culture is what this makes this continue to move forward. And whatever you think about how it might affect your personal health, it's creating such destruction in our economy, in our culture, in a lot of people's lives. I mean, plenty of people terribly. But we're not going to get through that until we do collectively feel that we are through it. And that's not going to happen until we have some compassion and make some changes for one another. I guess a lot of people are just waiting for the vaccine, but it's like, what lessons did we learn? I think that, frankly, there's multitude of lessons people are learning individually. We're all being presented with opportunities and doorways to walk through the challenges that we face. And some of us are walking through more of those than others. And look, all choices are valid. So I'm not trying to judge it necessarily from a meta spiritual level. So I trust that like that process is happening, whether or not we feel like there's massive like systemic changes that we wanted to see perhaps through the way COVID-19 burns down the house in a way. And I'm certainly not inviting collapse. I'm inviting change in the most peaceful and gentle way possible. But often ways, you know, the only ways we do that as human beings is through burning the fields in a sense. And we have been doing that. And I'm not looking for things to completely fall apart. And I don't think they will. But I know we're all very frayed along the edges, emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Financially, you know, all these different ways. So hang in there. Everything moves. The water continues to flow. And hang in there, folks. Just keep walking, okay? Keep breathing. But for now, let's put on our noggins so we can learn a bit from this great conversation with our dear friend, Keith Campbell. Well, thank you, Keith, so much for joining us. I've been digging into your new book, New Science of Narcissism, and reading through it, and I had some questions that have come up, and I'm hoping we can just kind of dive in.
Perfect. That's what I like to do.
I know you've been talking about this a lot, but I have a feeling you like talking about it, so that's okay, I hope.
I like, when people have questions, I'm happy to answer them, you know? Usually I'm teaching, everyone's looking at their phone, you know? Somebody cares.
So, you know, you're right that narcissism is a word that's bandied about a lot these days. And I bet a lot of people, if you ask them like, well, what does it mean to you? They have a broad definition. And one thing that came up by reading your book is that there's these different types of narcissism. But before I get into asking questions about it, I'm realizing that it's probably important and helpful if you can give us a little bit of a description about like what it is, because you also differentiate between sort of like natural narcissism and NPD or
the more clinical form.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you're right. People use it generally, and they usually mean somebody that's a little self-centered, kind of full of themselves, boastful, maybe a sense of entitlement. And that's accurate. Those are all kind of traits we ascribe to narcissism. But when we talk about it in more the research side, we talk about a couple different forms, really three. Yeah. But what you encounter mostly when you're talking to people about narcissism is this grandiose form of narcissism, which is this combination of maybe callousness and a lack of empathy and a sense of entitlement, but also maybe some drive and extroversion and ambition and maybe charisma and likability. So these are characters that you end up working for, going to politics. You see them in performance and entertainment because they're people that are kind of likable and driven, and they're full of themselves, but you put up with it because they're entertaining and they're fun to be around. You know, so that's this more grandiose form of narcissism. And so that's usually what people are talking about. And then there's this other form, which is people who have the same sense of entitlement and think, you know, they should be treated better by the world, but they're a little bit insecure. They have sort of low self-esteem, they're anxious, depressed, and we call this vulnerable narcissism. And there's other terms like thin-skinned or covert or hypersensitive narcissism. And so these are folks that, you know, they fantasize about being great, they fantasize about getting the attention they deserve, but they're a little bit shy to do it. And so they end up maybe talking to their therapist about it, or maybe you see it online a little bit, but you're not really seeing this grandiosity. You're seeing a lot of depression. I mean, that's how it manifests. People are like, I'm depressed. No one pays attention to me. And you go, you want love? No, I really just want people to realize what a great person I am and how awesome I am. Like, but you haven't really done anything. So that's more the vulnerable form. And I should point out, people can have both aspects of both these traits in their personality.
Sure.
To make it a little more complicated. And the vulnerable form is what people often will see who are therapists, because these folks will end up in therapy more. And then there's this form of narcissism where it becomes extreme and inflexible. So imagine you're very narcissistic. You're very, you know, you're you're callous, you lack empathy, you want to be around special, important people, you want people to tell you how much they admire you all the time, so you're attention-seeking, you use people as props in your life so you get attention, and it becomes so bad, it becomes a disorder. You know, you're like, your marriage falls apart because you can't love your kids, you know? That really extreme and inflexible narcissism is narcissistic personality disorder, or NPD. And that has a lot of grandiosity, but also vulnerability in it as well. So sometimes what happens, people are talking about this clinical form of narcissism, but really that's relatively rare. You know, 1-2% of the population at any time would be diagnosed as NPD. But there are a lot of people who are narcissistic where it kind of messes up their life. But it's not a clinical disorder. It's just a personality.
That's what I wanted to get to. Is like, I'm not hearing you really say it. I'm guessing you're not saying that narcissism as a thing is inherently pejorative, that it depends, like, and it has this spectrum. And so I want to know, where is the line where it does become an impairment to the world, really?
Yeah, and maybe I should be more direct about that. People use narcissism. It's usually a pejorative thing. Like, no one's like, "Hey, Keith, you're such a narcissist." I'm not like, "Great."
Right.
You know, it's usually
sweet, vulnerable narcissism. Yeah,
right, sweet. Yeah. It's usually not considered positive. And the reason is because it's interpersonally. If somebody's narcissistic, it means they're kind of selfish and mean, and we don't really like people like that. So it's not something you want to be called. But when you look at it as a trait in the world, like I do, I think of it as a trade-off, that narcissism is really good in some situations. It's really harmful in some situations. And it works at low levels, but if it gets too extreme, it can be a problem. And so I very much see narcissism as existing on a spectrum where we're all kind of in there. And even in life, you know, when you're younger, you're going to be more narcissistic. As you get older, you get kicked around a little bit, your narcissism goes down. So I see it as something that exists on a spectrum. And this is pretty consistent in the field. It exists on a spectrum, and it's a trade-off where it has benefits in certain contexts, especially in the short term or in context of power or leadership. And it has a lot of costs, and those costs are usually, you know, borne by other people, or you see them in the long term. So you might be a really narcissistic celebrity, and you have this great life, and you feel you're awesome, and you die alone, and it sucks because you're suffering, and you have no one there. And so I look at these narcissistic individuals, and I don't get mad. I'm just like, you're going to suffer later. It's too bad for you. But I see it as a trade-off, if that makes sense.
It sounds like you're saying narcissism is a trade-off for sort of like 3D level reality, ground level kind of gains, as opposed to spiritual gains or soul gains, typically.
Yes. I mean, if you want to put in that level, it's interesting because, in the spiritual world, you see lots of narcissistic spiritual leaders.
Ironic, or maybe, yeah, or maybe it's perfect because it's sort of showing you like the hunger is there. I don't know.
The hunger's there, but it's such a great place for people. So if you're an academic, if I do quantitative personality science and you walk in and go, I'm the best at it. I'm like, you're not. You just can't do it. It's like my buddies who are jazz musicians. They'd say you go to New York and they'd make you play Phoenix and B flat double time. And if you couldn't do it, you were out. They can tell who's good or not. You can't fake it. You go into the spiritual world, no one knows. So you're like, I'm an enlightened master. And you're going to convince some people because they're hungry. So there's a lot of flexibility. And when there's flexibility, you get ego. But yeah, I think it can be a real block to spiritual growth. But again, you know, like I'm a yogi and I watch the Netflix show on Bikram, you know,
I saw that. Yeah.
He's a wonderfully narcissistic character. I mean, I was laughing.
Pretty classic, yeah.
I mean, I shouldn't laugh because he's kind of seems like a horrible dude too. But so narcissistic, you know, doing the practice, when he was watching people doing the practice in 104 degrees and he's got his own personal air conditioner.
Right, right.
And the Mauna Kea Beach Club towel. That's something no one would pick up, but I did. You know, the Rockefeller Hotel towel. And I mean, it was, it, and so I'm laughing at this, but this is total narcissism. But, and he kind of stole the practice from someone who really wasn't that narcissistic, but because he was such a showman, he was able to spread it everywhere. And the truth is, it kind of works. I go do a Bikram series, you know, they just changed the name now. So it's a real trade-off. I can't, so on one hand, I'm like, thanks for that. I really appreciate your series. On the other hand, I'm like, you're kind of a bad guy.
Yeah. And this is, I thought, I was having a conversation with Aubrey Marcus on his show the other day, and we were talking about like these things that drive us and these aspects, I guess, of our ego or our psyche that is like the fire. And those are, some of these are aspects of narcissism. And without them, in some ways, there'd be no wood on the fire of incarnation. There would be no grist for the mill. Like it kind of like, you could look at it like that's what creates the karma. It's like, and so we kind of need, we don't want to disown these things because maybe narcissism in some ways is playing a role so that we can do things and be motivated. And
there's a, I didn't know we're going, I should have known by your name we were going to go in this direction. But yeah, so there's this, so there's these old stories that you always hear about Asian teaching, which is different than, you know, the guru model is very different than my model. I'm like, question me, students, let's brawl. And, and it's not a more of a, it's not a respect model as much as yet. But there's a story about somebody taking a student, shoving his head in a river till he almost drowns. And then says, when you want to, you know, reach enlightenment as badly as you wanted to live, come work with me. So there's those stories that you need this incredible ambition to achieve some sort of spiritual growth. It's a hard job. And so there's going to be a lot of ego that goes into that, but the ego is going to be a detriment at some point in the progress because it's going to keep you grounded in yourself. So it's, I don't understand this. I'm a psychologist. I'm not a spiritual kind of guy.
Well, you're a yogi. You're an explorer of your inner space. I mean, if anything, I would say because of your interest in psychology and devoting your life to it, it's like you have an inherent interest.
I do some, like I do some work on ayahuasca and stuff. So I hang out with some folks that are working at that more spiritual level. And I like to stay in my own lane and say, look, I understand the psychology very well, but you start opening the third eye. it's a little out of my depth. And like, I have a bunch of maps that are real good for the normal world and the spiritual world, they fall apart a little bit. So I try to say that there's another set of tools up there and I don't have all those. And it gets really interesting with things like ego, because there's so many spiritual people that are so freaking egotistical.
Yes.
And then other ones like the Dalai Lama, who are incredibly powerful people, powerful leaders. He's one of the greatest leaders ever in a weird way. Very strong person, but it just zero narcissism.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like he works about 4 hours a day on kind of reducing his own ego, but keeping his ego strength. And he even talks about the ego as being kind of a duality, that you need it, but you don't need it. It's tough.
Do you think there's a role going on with like technology, particularly the iPhone and the smartphone? So the last 10 years, and I looked at things like this, that wonderful documentary, Social Dilemma on Netflix, which I assume you saw. And I thought it's fascinating. And I personally feel like these things are exacerbating all of these narcissistic tendencies. And a lot of us aren't even realizing what it's doing to our brains. It feels like a problem.
Yeah, it is. There's so much in that question. So I watched a little bit of the Social Dilemma, and I know a lot of these Facebook, and I kind of knew about the stuff going on. And so it wasn't really surprising.
Yeah.
But then when I saw it, I'm like, well, when you put it that way, I guess it really is kind of surprising. So social media seems to be really ripe ground for narcissism. So because you're able to take an image of yourself and project it and fix it before you put it out there, you can kind of sculpt it edit it and make it work. So when social media started, I mean, we started doing research on it right at the beginning because when I first saw it, I'm like, oh my God, this is narcissism. And so you find narcissism spreads in all these networks because they're shallow, they're sort of materialistic, they're surface level. It's not a love network, it's an ego network in a lot of ways. So narcissism spreads and maintained on these networks, but we don't really see that social media is turning people into narcissists. That's what I originally thought, but it seems like a lot of people just get real depressed and turned off by it because, you know, like I do yoga with these influencers. Like if you're a yogi, I'll go in and back before the plague, you know, I'd walk in and right. these guys would roll in off the beach in Ibiza and they're 6'5" and ripped. And I assume they're influencers. I don't know. They're so attractive. Now imagine like you see people like that all the time and you start going, God, I'm a horrible person. Everyone's beautiful and they're in Dubai and I'm a loser. And so that there's sort of a blowback with social media for some people. So I think it's led some people's narcissism really explode and some people have gotten very depressed.
But what about the way that narcissism, when it kind of has its own life, it leads to less cooperative behavior? And like something they're talking about in that documentary is about connecting the dots to the polarization that we're seeing and like globally. And so, I mean, that to me seems like a really, really big issue. And so it might not be making narcissism maybe worse, but
yeah, maybe I'm sorry. I'm cracking up. It's so I shouldn't laugh. This is the problem with this is how I cope with depression is I just laugh. So when they started Facebook, and I think, and I talked to enough people who knew Zuck, and they say he's a good dude. I've never met him, and he's legit, doesn't want the world to end.
But what kind of narcissist is he, do you think? I mean, vulnerable?
People who I don't know. I mean, like I said, the people I know him, say he's not a bad guy, but he has a lot of those really vulnerable qualities. He's not a showman. He's not like a Musk figure, you know. He's much quieter, reserved.
Yeah.
I just don't really know because he doesn't have a very strong personality.
I'm putting you on the spot there.
Yeah, I know. And I'm careful not to be super dismissive of people now because I found myself doing it so easily in the past. But when they started saying we're going to connect everyone and we're going to get everyone to hug I thought this isn't how people work. You bring people together, they kill each other. I mean, I'm a social psychologist, you know, I just think this is crazy. But they really thought that would happen, I think. And they managed to bring the degrees of separation of people and kind of cut it in half from 6 to 7 to maybe 3.5.
Yeah.
And so that to me, that's really a profound thing that people don't talk about a lot. And what that did was just it led to a lot of cool stuff. I mean, it was really interesting stuff happens when you link the world up, but you get huge amounts of conflict because you're just bringing all these different people together and they start sorting into groups and they're sorting into groups at scale that no one even understands. And what groups do is they fight with each other.
Well, it's not just that they're sorting into groups. I mean, the algorithms are funneling them into their own tunnels of information. So it's sort of like you're no longer able to be cooperative because you're only seeing it just more and more truncates like ideas.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what you see in a lot of the social work, social psych work and the communication sociology work is you'll see people that they get them in these reinforcement feedback loops. So if you're on the right, you get the right, right, right. You're on the left, you get left, left, left. And the way people... When groups polarize, the people that are the coolest are always the most extreme. You know, right. So if you're in the good guys group, you're going to want the best guy. And if you're in the bad guys group, you want the meanest guy in charge. Like when I was a kid, we had like the Oakland Raiders. They were like the tough football team. And the coolest Raiders guys were the guys in the fans that were kind of drunk, smoking cigarettes, you know. They were because they were the real fans. But if you were a good team, the good, nice team, the fans would be the nice. Anyway, groups polarize. So we're setting up this system that demands people get funneled into extremes and then they fight. Yeah, of course. That's the way it's wired. It's terrible.
Have you found though that if humans generally are exposed to diversity of ideas and people, that actually that leads to like an inherent cooperativeness?
No, not at all. No, people. This is old.
The tribalism is just built into our genes.
Yes. This is classic social psych. So you take people, you can put them into groups very, very easily. I mean, the old days, they'd just say, estimate how many things were in a jar. And if you said this, you give them a number, they go, okay, you're an overestimator. You're in this group. And they used to divide, you're an art guy. They'd appreciate this. They used to tell kids, like I always saw these studies going, do you like this painting? It was Paul Klee versus Kandinsky. And they look kind of the same. And people are like, okay, you like Klee, you're on this team. You like Kandinsky, you're on this group. And the groups would start to fight. It's very easy to get people to identify with groups and get them to compete with each other. It's just it's part of our nature. That's why we split up all the time.
I mean, it's something in that epigenetic, like we've just learned to like protect because we had to.
Yes. I mean, it's very interesting how people's ego works. So at an individual level, people who are narcissistic are the combative ones. So if I'm going to, and this is what's going on now politically with, you know, all the shaming that's going on, the people that are out there in your face are going to be narcissists. Doesn't matter what side, because they're willing to go out there and push their opinion on you.
Mm-hmm.
So individually, people that are jerks are narcissists. But when you start aggregating into groups, the groups made out of really cooperative people can be really, really nasty when they fight other groups.
Yeah. Well, so we see that a lot.
Yeah. So you think of the Japanese in World War II. You go to Japan right now. If we flew to Tokyo, we were walking around. Everyone would love us. Or no, we'd feel totally safe. People would be kind to us. Everybody would be cooperative. It'd be great. But you bring that group as a group in World War II and give them a mission and say protect the God Emperor. You know this. Yep. You got to protect your group, and you get all these really group oriented people together, and they'll go crush anyone. So when you get a bunch of loving people together at scale, they can turn into a narcissistic group, if that makes sense. So these things work a little differently where we are.
Man, this gets into me thinking about like free will. And like, because you write a chapter on sort of like, in essence, self-monitoring our own narcissism or ways to notice it and what to do about it. So I want to talk about that, because at the end of the day, it does come down to individuals making choices, and whether or not it's groupthink or how much agency they have over those choices. Yeah. It is about the person listening to this right now, and they'd be like, look, I don't want to be lost in my narcissism. I want to be making the world a better place. How can they self-police that?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially now. And I hadn't thought about it till even this discussion. But you can see when you don't know who you are, you can get caught up in different ways. One, you can get caught up with kind of the ego beast. Like, you're freaking awesome. Look how good looking you are, you know. And you start to get feeding your own ego, and you start cutting yourself off from people. And the other way you get cut off is you start getting sucked into the herd. You know, you start getting sucked into the social media. And I don't know who I am, but if I identify with something else that's bigger than me, I can feel stable.
And a lot of that. Yeah.
And there's a lot of both those things going on right now. And it's really, they're both really dangerous. And I think the challenge is like, how do you just know who the hell you are? With narcissism and regulating your own narcissism, often it has to do with the interpersonal processes, I think, because that's where I see a lot of the problems people have. It's like, if you're narcissistic in the recording studio, big deal. If I'm narcissistic with a bunch of people talking about science, you know, nerding out, it's fine. If I'm narcissistic with my family, with my friends, when I'm with normal people, you know, that those interpersonal spaces is where your own ego can kind of damage you. And so what I suggest to people is try to notice that, and maybe you're not being compassionate enough. Maybe you realize like, God, I don't have the loving relationships other people have. This is something people notice. You know, they want to have loving relationships. Something I notice is, you know, I'm fine at a podcast because I can talk forever, but I go talk to people and I'll just talk over them all the time. I don't listen. I'll just overwhelm people because my personality, I'm like, I try to dial that back. I'm like, just, you know, start to notice where your ego's interfering with other people and dial it back.
Yeah.
So a lot of it for me is sort of focus on those interpersonal domains. Take a moment to listen to other people, see what they're doing. And really, if you can get your interpersonal life right, where people go, you know, Keith's a decent guy. East is a decent guy. He seems like a good guy. If you got that right, your ego won't get you in too much trouble. I mean, you might, but you avoid most of the problems having good relationships.
Yeah. I would think that in some ways doing things like service acts or anything that's sort of not about you helping others would be sort of ways of tilling the soil and setting the stage.
The challenge with that is that people do service acts in a couple different ways. And one way is a service act where you kind of give up yourself. And another way is a service act where you ride in as a hero and go tell people how to be better, and you bestow your goodness on the world. And so I think you can frame service in a way that really is something like in yoga, that the devotional yoga, you know, the bhakti yoga, I guess would be the term.
This seva,
It's more devoted. It's whatever I can't do. Let me just put it that way. It's very, whatever is a real struggle for me. That kind of service, I think, is important. But sometimes people go like, "Yeah, I'm doing service. What does that mean? Well, I'm just going to these dumb people and I'm providing my expertise and wisdom." And that could be a way to reinforce ego.
But if it's, I mean, I'm going back to thinking about like, what if that's, I mean, is there ever such a thing as selfless service, you know?
I like to think that there is, but I think so the reason I have this concern is because when we started studying things like community leadership, this was a question we had in a bunch of data. And that's something that people who are narcissistic love. That seems to be very strongly predicted by narcissism.
Community leadership.
It's just a weird item. This is just a weird item that we have in these sociology measures. But it's one of those things where it kind of struck me for a while. Why are these people that are narcissistic wanting to be community leaders? Well, because they're leaders. They want to go and run stuff. They want to be in charge. They want status. It's not a bad way to get status. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. In fact, a lot of the ways people deal with ego is they put it in something pro-social. So you say, you know, I'm going to drive a Prius because people think I'm a do-gooder, but at least I'm driving kind of a better car. Or there's an old Buddhist story, it's probably from the 60s, of a priest who died, had such a big ego, he wanted a monument for himself. So he planted a tree. He figured, well, I got a monument, but at least I'm providing shade for people. So you try to align the ego with doing good for people. So I think that idea is really important. But if you want service as a way to kind of make you a better person, I think there's a risk in that the service needs to be not about you.
Yeah, this stuff can get tricky. You also wrote a little bit in the book about psychedelics as a change agent. And that's something I talked to a lot of people in the psychedelic research field. And so I'm very familiar. I think a lot of listeners probably are about some of that research and what's going on. And it's pretty nascent, but it's also a lot of energy in it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So I have a student, Brandon Weiss, who's a graduate student. He's doing he finished his PhD, and he's anyway kind of finishing up as they do, kind of postdocs and stuff. And he's a psychedelic researcher, and he did his dissertation on ayahuasca. So we've been studying personality change in ayahuasca for about 3 years. So that's kind of I have a very limited knowledge.
Yeah.
But it turns out I kind of know more than a lot of people just because no one knows anything. But I am not a psychedelic researcher. I just have done some. And so what we've looked at is the plant medicine, you know, basically studying people who've gone to these centers in Peru and more recently in Costa Rica and done a kind of the classic, you know, week or two of ceremonies, three or four ceremonies. And what we find in the personality change is that the biggest changes are on traits having to do with neuroticism. So like depression, anxiety, hostility. That people's change seems to be in those areas primarily. And those numbers are actually pretty big. I mean, this isn't clinical science, this is personality science, but the numbers, my jaw kind of dropped at some of these changes.
Wow.
Very positive. And I've talked to, Kelly at Heroic Hearts and some of these groups that work with vets going down to treat PTSD. And I think the reason why the plant medicines are so important with, you know, so effective with things like PTSD, or maybe that look that way. I shouldn't say they haven't done really good trials, but they look that way. It's because it's helping with this neuroticism piece, this anxiety and this depression and this. So when we look at something like narcissism, it's a little more complicated because on one hand, you think with their vulnerability should get better. People should be less neurotic and less unstable, and we should see some improvement there. And I think we do. We have looked at the data, but it was very quickly. I mean, it was Brandon sent me some stuff. But you also see maybe people are going to get more extroverted a little bit. And that might lead to more grandiose narcissism. So I think as a narcissism treatment, I think these plant medicines aren't going to be the bright thing. I think they might be for some people. But I think for things like addictions, PTSD, depression, anxiety, yeah. I mean, they're going to be dynamite.
Yeah. Narcissism, I keep trying to remind myself that, like, you know, it's not like something you're trying to completely ameliorate, because in a lot of ways, yeah, it's like it's a necessary part of our personality in the world to get things moving forward. Like you're saying, if it's a motivation to be more extroverted for someone who wasn't doing anything, I mean, perhaps that's good.
Right. You know? Right. You get somebody who's kind of shy and they're kind of haven't been doing much. And then now they feel some love for themselves and some peace. And like, I'm going to go out and make some friends. I'm going to go out and make a difference. Well, that takes a little ego to do that. You're not turning people into egomaniacs.
Sure.
Now, you do find people with psychedelics that get inflated, just like you do with all spiritual stuff. And maybe I run into these people, they're like, dude, everything's God. It's all consciousness. I'm just a manifestation of consciousness on this earth. And I'm like, yeah. So, okay, great. But they get really inflated with it. Right. And so that's a risk with these psychedelics I don't know enough to know how they screen for that, except maybe with bipolar disorder or something. But I do think that's a risk where people can see something really profound and have to share it with everybody. I don't know. What's your experience with that? Because you sounded.
Well, I've had a lot of personal experience, and I'm just familiar with the studies, and I know some people involved in the different studies, and I've worked on creating music for some of those. But I've just seen a lot of people in psychedelic circles that it's a mixed bag. Like, on one hand, which is just an interesting anecdote, I would meet a lot of people who are psychiatrists and psychologists doing the work themselves personally. They're fascinated by it. Yeah. They would say, oh, this is like doing 10 years of therapy and a week. You know, it's so intense.
I think it was 100 years of psychoanalysis in 10 minutes might have been my
pretty
line.
Much. I mean, it's yeah, really
it's,
humbling
got that
at
same
times.
Line. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so people who love the inner landscape and study it, I think they can be quite fascinated by this. But I also see people who keep coming back over and over and over again. And I sort of just wonder, like, well, the purpose of it seems to be to have these felt experiences and face things and then come back to the world to make whatever sorts. I mean, you're meant to be, we're here.
Yeah.
This is what we're doing. And so it's sort of like Ram Dass had a line about always getting high, but then you have to come down. And so you want to be on this yo-yo, or eventually you're going to be here. So you're not having to be going up and down all the time.
Yeah. And, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water.
And that's
something I talk to a lot of people in these kind of communities, and I find it, you can tell, I find it fascinating. And I've done my training, I only talk about things as an expert that I'm an expert in. And my training in this is, I mean, I've got my junior shaman's license, it's just ridiculous. It's kind of like my little patch, I'd have no business talking to anyone about it except as the personality side. So I guess what I worry about with some of the psychedelic training is when people discover this without the self, without training, they're like, they get this mind. I imagine a kid smoking DMT and seeing a bunch of deities and no container to put that in, no space to put it in.
That's a big point. Yeah.
It would be a risk more so than somebody who's really practice some shamanic medicine where there's a place to put this stuff in. There's a container. I can make sense out of what you just saw. We call it this. People see this all the time. And so you're less likely to just go, I'm the only person who's ever seen God. And maybe some of it is just the structure, and we don't have the right structures because we have this tool psychedelics. I mean, this is just me. When I first kind of ran into this stuff as a social psychologist, I was talking to Catherine McLean. I don't know if you know her. She worked.
She's been on the show.
She's the coolest. Yeah, she's great. Right? Yeah. Oh, she's awesome. Right. So I ran into her at a conference and I invited her down to Georgia and just because I was curious and talked to her about it. What am I saying? I don't even know what I'm saying. I got so excited. Knew her. I love this stuff. Go on.
She's done a lot of interesting research, and she's obviously kind of stepped out in certain ways, sort of disillusionment with, I think she gets into a lot of interesting stuff about like medicalization versus decriminalization and like the pros and cons, right, and how we're going to like hold this stuff in society as it comes forth. And you talked about The Container. And yes. I think that's music to me, if you look at ceremonies for thousands of years, the music is the central guide. Whether it's a Lakota Sweat Lodge or an Ayahuasca Icaros songs or whatever it is. And there's probably a reason how that helps us and what role it plays. And a lot of these studies, I think that's a really, really, really important thing not to overlook. And I know it's challenging to quantify and qualify it because it's music, but it's a big part of what the experience is and how positive it is for people. And we need to have that ritual, that the aspect of ritual and ceremony itself and guidance is a large part beyond just the chemical that you're putting into your body and your brain.
Absolutely. Respond to that. In anthropology, we talk about sort of creating liminal space. You know, there's a term that maybe people listening aren't familiar with, the limen. So we talk about the consciousness and the unconscious. And in between that, they used to call it a limen. And we don't use the term limen much, but we say subliminal still. So we say below the limen, but we don't talk about the limen. So the idea is there's this threshold between conscious and unconsciousness. And when you activate and you stay, hover right at that threshold. You don't go unconscious like you're dreaming, but you just hover there. It's a state of liminality. So anthropologists got really interested in this because this is what rituals do. They put you in a liminal state and that allows your consciousness to be changed. A Catholic service puts you in a liminal phase, a dead show puts you in a liminal phase, and when you do an ayahuasca ceremony, the shaman will say the Icaros, so really what's doing the work. You know, back in the day, the shaman would drink the ayahuasca, but you wouldn't. You'd just sit there and you'd be sung over. And so these things are super important. And I know, and this is me. This is kind of, I'm at the bro science level. I apologize. This is me talking
That's
to
all
the,
we do. That's all I do.
This is me talking to this is just me gossiping with the kids, the young, smart PhDs. But it sounds like people are really working on building some soundtracks that are going to kind of work. And it sounds like maybe you know something about this. And I'd be super curious because I've been up to Mongolia with throat singing. I've been to those things and this stuff is just really powerful. So what's your take?
Yeah, there's a guy named Mendo Kaelin who was working at Imperial College London with Robin Carhart Harris, who's doing their research on psilocybin in particular. And Mendel was, I believe, a postdoc or doctoral student as well, if I'm getting that right. And he was interested in the music side. He's one of few people who's done actual research on music in these psychedelic studies. And I found that the playlist they were creating for like Johns Hopkins psilocybin research and even Imperial College, NYU and others, that none of the music was written for the psychedelic space. It's all great music, not all of it. It's a matter of taste. But it's like and I had been sort of creating music for many years that was actually specifically designed for that use. And I just discovered on my own like things that I thought made it better, including like it being longer so you could be in these sort of spaces and the use of field recordings and nature sounds and certain musical techniques of tension and release and blah, blah, blah. And I wanted to create not just a complaint, but it's like, well, here's what's working for me. And it's what I think is needed more than anything, Keith, is sort of like an American shamanic tradition in a sense. Like we have these bits of these sort of tentacles of thousands of years of like an Icaros and so forth, which is great and they work, they're fantastic. But it'd be great if we're like, well, what do we need? And what is also the musical language, the harmonics and the things that you and I have grown up with? So it's a familiarity to it, but it's using the same musical technology.
Yeah.
And that's not been studied. That's not been pulled apart and not been discovered. And that, I feel like, is a real frontier.
Well, part of the reason none of this has been studied is it's illegal. I mean, I have to get it costs too damn much money. I can't do it.
It's hard to research.
Yeah, it just costs a bunch of money. So the stuff we've done has been kind of bootstrapped. When Robert Hunter was given LSD by the CIA, I think, or by MKUltra, the story I heard is he went back to Jerry Garcia and said, put on a raga, you know, put on a... Oh, man, who are they listening to? Ravi Shankar.
Yeah.
Put on some Ravi Shankar and take this. So the first thought he had was put on an Indian raga. And I'm not a musician, but ragas are a long form, kind of constantly evolving.
Improvisational. And it's deeply tied to this. Like the improvisation is, I mean, I talk about not knowing a lot about this, but a little bit. It's infused with the soul. Like, it's supposed to be like God in a sense, you know, and that's the whole point. It has all these rules, musical rules, but it's all about the improvisation.
It's inspired.
It's about being in the flow.
Okay. Yeah. So then my favorite kind of jazz musician, Alice Coltrane, was I love her. Buddhist. I mean, a study with Yogananda in California, and then started putting out this incredible kind of monastic jazz that with Pharoah Sanders, this stuff that I just find wonderful.
Yeah.
And then it disappeared. But I'm like, well, we got kind of some, and then I'm kind of a deadhead, man. I'm just hate to admit it. I'm old, but you know, I could listen to Dark Star for 35 minutes and feel good about it. So we have some tradition of that here that we do. But we don't have our own. We're kind of making one, but I don't know.
We are making one, but if you look at how it was done inside psychedelic ceremonies, it was very regimented and experimented on for hundreds of years, probably. And they came up with the songs, they came up with they came up with the method. And I'm like, first, like mushrooms, psilocybin, 99% of people have only used it recreationally. They've never been like created a ceremony around it, or and let alone like, oh, this is the way we do it in our people. There's no elders really to be like, here's the method, you know, whether or not you choose to do it. We don't have it.
Yeah. And we might have. And who's we anyway, by the way? Like, who are our elders? I mean, do I go to Celtic traditions? Do I go to, you know,
because thing, and I think part of the problem is that it's like the American energy is sort of like, hey, you do it how you want to do it.
Yeah, you pick a little bit of this and you pick a little of that. And I think, you know, I think what's happening in these centers in Latin America with ayahuasca is they're building these new systems. I mean, they're building, they're interpreting the medicine. I mean, I haven't studied this. It's just kind of me spitballing, guessing. They're using, you know, that Bufo or the 5-MeO, what is Sapo? I don't know what they call it there. They're using that, which is something they just discovered. But now the indigenous folks are using that in ceremonies. So there's some of this, like, I think of a little bit of like psychedelic MMA, you know, when martial arts were all separate and everyone kind of practiced their thing. And then someone said, let's just see who's the best in the octagon, you know, in the kumite. And everyone fought. And then they kind of figured out these two forms work and they started evolving them. And I think some of this is going on because, like I said, I'm not a psychonaut. I'm a dad. I just don't know. But when I talk to people, they're like, yeah, we're hanging out in these graveyards in northern India, taking mushrooms. And I'm like, that's interesting. There's got to be interesting stuff that's going on.
Oh, I'm sure it's – you can – by the way, you can be a psychonaut and a dad at the same time. But anyway, if anything, I think like from a social standpoint, one of the reasons it's exploding right now is more a symptom of the – kind of intense change we're experiencing as a civilization. Like, we're trying to thread the needle through something that's pretty like challenging and also just exploding at the same time. And it was sort of all hands on deck, and you're seeing people grabbing for different tools. And those are very, as you found in just the ayahuasca research your student did, for some people, it can make some pretty fast, dramatic shifts.
very huge and very positive shifts too. Negative, yeah. I mean, it's high risk, but very positive shifts. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed is we're kind of, you know, that I kind of get stuck on is this 50-year cycle where we're going back to the, you know, civil rights movement and the space race and the reconnection with India and the consciousness movement. And we're kind of like, I'm kind of hoping it kicks off in the next year or two and that gets us out of this mess. I don't know. That's what I'm...
Well, that it's actually leads into what I wanted to ask you is how are you hopeful personally? Like when you kind of look at all this stuff and all this research and everything, all the work you've done.
I am hopeful. I used to be a very cynical person though. So I don't think my hope is grounded in reality. I think it's grounded more in personality. And now I just decided I'm going to view the world, but I've studied social systems and social change and generational processes a long time. And I spent a lot of time looking at it and people in this business were kind of waiting for the world to go to hell in 2020. You know, there's different models predicted it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
2020 in particular.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like Peter Turchin's models predicted 2020, the generational stuff. Strauss and Howe did. They called it the fourth turning. So I've been waiting for this forever.
Okay.
But there's these turnings and you go back and they're kind of on these different cycles. So the last one was 68, the 70s, but the other one before that was, you know, 1920s. So these very intense generational cycles where things get chaotic, you can't really make sense of things. And we're in that kind of space now. And when you're in a space of chaos, my usual advice is go backwards, go deep, figure out what you had before. Go, you know, like if you're musically, when music dies, you know, music kind of runs out, people go back to the past. Let's go listen to some old records. Let's rediscover rock and roll. Let's rediscover, you know, so you kind of go, well, maybe people should start looking inwards. And I don't know it seems like right now everyone's just going crazy, but maybe the psychedelics will help people look inward. I think it might help with some trauma with people.
Why I have a lot going on, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of people who can't connect with each other. And I think the MDMA can help with that. I'm sort of optimistic that that this will help people with suffering. But
at the end of your book, you talk about like sort of like an anecdote is essentially like an energy of love as sort of obvious as it seems, but maybe there's no better way to put it. It's inclusive. Yeah, it's cooperative.
I think so. It's not a real scientific way of thinking about it, but I like, what the hell? I've had a career. I can be a little more loose. But very much to me, if people are out there like, I want to be the best, I want to be better than everybody. I'm like, great. We need people who are out there being the best and killing it and being the best at everything. Have an ego, man. But have a heart too. And if you have an ego and you don't have a heart, you become a monster, you know, but if you have an ego and you have a heart, you can be a warrior, you know, you can be a great person. And so the more I kind of puzzle around with this, I'm like, if people focus on the heart piece, you can let the ego maybe take care of itself a little more, if that makes sense.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's a great way to kind of close things up. That's a great message to kind of end with. Yeah. How can people find your work and connect with your new book?
WKeithCampbell.com. We put up a website with some narcissism tests. I can't say the word either.
You said it
narcissism
too much,
lab. You know, in the old days, it was narcissism.
Narcissism.
You know, it was easier. You know, they added that, you know, they made it more complicated.
It's a tough one.
But yeah, narcissismlab.com or books anywhere. It's the usual stuff.
Wonderful. Well, I'll link to it in the show notes as well. And I just want to thank you for giving us some of your time. And I know you've been doing a lot of interviews and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, thanks. That was really fun.
Well, thank you, Keith, for joining us. I feel like I got a new friend and it was really fun to talk. Check out his book. It's quite interesting if you want to take a deep dive into the subject to keep your ears and eyes wide open as to all things narcissistic. This song that you are hearing in the background is called Washed, and it is from the Spores album. You can listen to Spores wherever you listen to music. on Spotify, Apple, or you can download it in high res at eastforest.org, and you can also get a vinyl there. We have that current discount code community2020 that goes until December 3rd. So there's a vinyl bundle, actually, while supplies last. That's an incredible savings, especially when you add in that code. Thanks for giving the podcast a review, guys. Thanks for sending all your notes of support on social media, at East Forest Instagram, at East Forest Music, Facebook, and thanks for showing your interest in the Salt Lake City Winter Show. All that's at East Forest, so check out .org. Check out if you'd like to learn more information. Okay, guys, hope you had a good Thanksgiving. Hang in there. Things are crazy. You're not. Keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit, but if you do, do it with grace.